Thank you very much. Can you hear me at the back? Is the microphone working? Okay. I really welcome this chance to talk about some of these issues, because to my mind, giving meaning to actions that seem ostensibly irrational, like burning down your own community, or purposeless, i.e. without well-articulated aims, is one of the principal tasks of criminology. But I welcome it as well because I was really dismayed by the initial language of the government response, which was to say that that the events were about criminality pure and simple. And that seemed to me at best rather tautological, and at worst something of an attack on social science and criminology, though I guess it seemed to me that probably it was rhetoric pure and simple rather than a serious attempt to explain what had occurred. And my area of expertise is prisons, so I did wonder why Friedrich had asked me to talk on this matter. But in my dim and distant past, I used to read a lot of cultural studies and sociology of culture, so I want to use one or two ideas from that past to help us think about one or two of the characteristics of the riots. And of course, as Friedrich said, the riots actually involved all sorts of different events and crimes, ranging from arson to burglary. So I think really it's the mission of a fool or a genius to try to explain too much. So all I want to do is present one or two ideas. And I'm not saying anything all that original when I point out that the riots were different in some quite important ways from previous episodes of rioting in the UK. So the riots of the 1980s, which Friedrich mentioned, had a stronger racial component. They were linked more explicitly to feelings of social exclusion and alienation, and they had a clearer political target. As with the riots in the French suburbs or the Parisian suburbs a few years ago, I think one of the striking things about the riots here last summer was that there was no message to deliver. There was no slogan or manifesto for reform. But more significantly, I think, what seems to distinguish the riots last summer from comparable events in the past was the level of looting. This is something that Tim Newbern has mentioned in his study. So the sense that this was an opportunity to get free stuff. And I'm really interested in what that stuff was, because although in some of the areas that were looted, what was taken were kind of basic goods, nappies, biscuits, if that counts as basic, but basic consumer goods. In other places, it was very clear that these were not breadline riots. These were not the riots of absolute poverty. I'm interested in some of Zygmunt Bauman's descriptions or explanations of what these protests are about. And Bauman has said that these were the protests of, quote, defective and disqualified consumers. So what he's interested in, and what I'm pursuing a bit here, is that the object of desire of the people who ransacked many of the shops were mainstream consumer goods. And Bauman says that it's these temptations whose absence is most violently resented by those people who are simultaneously stimulated to be consumers, but also denied the opportunity to participate fully in consumer society. Now, as far as I can tell, Bauman doesn't really acknowledge the fact that this relationship between aspiration and the opportunity to fulfill those aspirations has been a long-standing concern of criminology. But I'm willing to forgive him that, because I think what he does nicely is articulate the degree to which consumerism and self-respect have become intertwined. And what Bauman says is that within the discourse of consumerism, and this is a quote, the fullness of consumer enjoyment means fullness of life. So Bauman says, not to shop makes you a non-entity. Now, in many ways that description might seem a bit exaggerated, but it resonated with me because of things that prisoners have said to me during my research about this relationship, not just between consumption and identity, but consumption and morality. So in prison, how you look and what you wear are forms of symbolic capital. They communicate to people your criminal success, but they do more than that. They're also taken as signs of personal ethics and self-respect. And I just want to read out a couple of quotations that illustrate this nicely. These were both in response to a question I asked about what gives you status in prison. So the first one is this: his cell, what he's got in it, what clothes he wears, what trainers he's got on. If he's got scruffy clothes on and stubble around his face, if he's a tramp, you think, fucking hell. And if you see a man next to him, smart as you like, nice jumper, nice pair of jeans, bad boy pair of trainers, looking all fresh and sharp, you think they've got morals and that. The other guy obviously hasn't. And the second quote: if someone comes into your cell and they see you've got everything in your cell and your cell looks nice, they're going to think, well, obviously this guy's got something. You'll go into someone else's cell and he's got nothing in there. He might be hard, but he's got nothing. He don't know how to get things. He don't know how to sort himself. They'll look at you and think, he's got nothing, so he must be a nobody. Now, Bauman says that the riot can be seen not as a rebellion against consumerism, but an attempt to join the ranks by those who are excluded from it. And I think his most interesting observation is that the same stores were both ransacked and set on fire. And Bauman says that looting shops and setting them on fire derive from the same impulsion and gratify the same longing, this combination of desire and resentment. And I think that if we accept the argument that consumerism played some role, certainly doesn't explain everything at all, but that it plays some role in the riots, then I think that makes the absence of a political agenda easier to understand. Because how do you protest against something in which you're highly invested emotionally? Something that that envelops you and seduces you rather than oppresses you, and something that has no personification, no embodiment. It might be worth noting that many of the stores that were ransacked were those that best communicated to people their exclusion. So stores with normally high levels of security, shutters, security guards, and so on. But of course, it's also striking, first, that some targets were small family-owned shops. Second, that a great deal of the violence and vandalism took place within the communities that the rioters lived in. And third, that the heroes, certainly in the media narrative, were non-affluent Turkish, Sikh, Afro-Caribbean storeholders who visibly defended their properties. And reading some of the reports into the riots, it's clear that many rioters did feel that those places were not legitimate targets. But putting that aside, I think two things deserve comment. First, the cultural theorist Slavoj Žižek, who I don't normally like, makes what I think is a really interesting point, that aspect of the conflict was, and this is a quote, between two poles of the underprivileged: those who have succeeded in functioning within the system versus those who are too frustrated to go on trying. The conflict is not between different parts of society, it's between those with no stake in their community and those whose stakes are highest. And I think one of the important points there is that these people talk about these communities as if they're homogenous, and clearly they are not. And second, that it's really important that we try to understand the degree to which that we try to understand those people who, in effect, vandalised their own communities, and whether those people had any meaningful investment in those communities in the first place. So we know that urban gangs have a kind of pride in territory, but territory and community are not the same things. I just want to move on now to comment briefly about the atmosphere that seemed to characterise some of the events. And here I'm drawing mainly on the National Centre for Social Research report into young people's involvement in the riots, where you get some really fascinating glimpses into the emotional texture of the riots. And I just want to provide a couple of quotes. This was taken from a local newspaper report, Salford News, I think. And the quote says, "This was more of a party than an angry riot, as youngsters handed old people packets of cigs and tins of Carlsberg. All that was missing was the DJ." Or this quote from a young person who was interviewed while they were in custody about their involvement. "It was like a movie. So many people shouting and screaming, shops broken into and broken glass everywhere. So many youth, so many policemen, so many people I recognised, laughing, having fun, literally joking." And there are other really fascinating quotes in this report. So one person said that it was like a rave. Another said it was like a party. And the report notes that many of the young people, when they described what it was like to participate, were grinning, talking about the pleasures that they had taken, that that the normal order of things was briefly inverted. And those descriptions made me think, again, at the back of my mind, of the concept of the carnival, which is discussed by the Russian literary critic Mikhail Bakhtin. Stay with me. The carnival, Bakhtin says, is a politically radical event, a kind of festival in which the world for a brief period is turned upside down. There's a suspension of normal roles and rules and hierarchies. Fools become wise, kings become beggars. And I think this is quite helpful in terms of thinking about some of the motivations of the people involved. Not just that this was a thrill, though clearly it was for some people, an adrenaline rush, but also that this inversion of normal hierarchies was part of the pleasure. So society had been capsized. The normal fabric of social order had collapsed, and perhaps most importantly, the police, for a short period, did not seem to be in charge. And in Domination and the Arts of Resistance, James Scott describes these fantasies of inversion as a consistent discourse among the powerless. And you do hear these fantasies among prisoners, where I do, whom I research. So this is a quick quote. "I'll smile at them if that's what it takes for me to get through my sentence comfortably, but woe betide if I bump into you outside, because it's your turn to smile. You smile for me now." And so I suspect that the pleasure for some writers was not just looting of material goods, but the temporary feeling of revenge and invincibility, while for others it was the kind of disappearance of social norms, of the normal social rules, that meant that they did things that they later regretted. And again, one gets a very clear sense of that from some of the quotes in the National Centre for Social Research study. Just a couple. "It was literally a moment of madness. Everyone saw everyone else doing it, and so I thought I might as well do it as well." And a second, "Because everyone was doing it, people thought it was okay to just take free stuff." So finally, I think this puncturing of the normal terms of social order also helped explain the disproportionality of the sentences that were given to the people involved, which Friedrich showed earlier. These were expressive punishments designed to communicate and reassert state power at a time when the thin blue line of order had, for a brief period, disappeared.
Thank you, Ben. We had one... my view, very plausible interpretation, and we have also a recommendation for prevention. Introduce carnival in this country. Go to Cologne, you may see how it works there, or Düsseldorf in Germany. They had not had riots over the last 20 years, so perhaps. But Rio de Janeiro, Brazil is a little different. So, okay, we will now hear Professor Sherman.